Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We may be challenging assumptions today as we talk about recycling, so stay with us. Walmart plans to use 3 billion pounds of recycled plastic in its packaging and products by 2020. Coca-Cola has committed to recycling the equivalent of 75% of the bottles and cans sold in developed markets by 2020. San Francisco, San Diego, and Los Angeles all divert more than half their municipal waste from going to landfills, aided by extensive recycling and composting programs. And cities across the U.S., including Minneapolis and Austin, Texas, have adopted initiatives to ultimately produce zero landfill waste. Today, as I said, we're questioning one of the sacred cows of environmental awareness, recycling. Is recycling as green as we think it is? Last October, the New York Times published an opinion piece by journalist John Tierney titled The Rain of Recycling, rain as in rule, not precipitation. Tierney questions how much difference our recycling efforts can really make. He wrote, quote, "To offset the greenhouse impact of one passenger's round-trip flight between New York and London, you'd have to recycle roughly 40,000 plastic bottles, assuming you fly coach. If you sit in business or first class, where each passenger takes up more space, it could be more like 100,000. Tierney also, end quote. Tierney also quotes J. Winston Porter, former assistant administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, quote, "It makes sense to recycle commercial cardboard and some paper, as well as selected metals and plastics. But other materials rarely make sense, including food waste and other compostables. The zero waste goal makes no sense at all. It's very expensive with almost no real environmental benefit," end quote. We, most of us, assume that recycling is the right thing to do, that our combined recycling efforts can make a large positive impact in reducing our collective carbon footprint. Our guest today is a critic working to dispel the economic and environmental myths behind recycling. Professor Thomas Kinnaman chairs the economics department at Bucknell University in central Pennsylvania. He studies recycling and waste management practices in the United States and abroad. Professor Kinnaman is also former director of Bucknell's Environmental Studies Program. Welcome to Midday.
Hello, Sheila. Thanks for having me today.
So the quotes that I just read from John Tierney and from the former EPA deputy administrator, do they pretty much match what you think? That except for commercial cardboard and some paper, metals like aluminum, except for them, plastics and glass just doesn't make sense to recycle?
Well, I agree with the fact that each material has a very separate life cycle signature associated with it, and to treat the, to assume that recycling is good for everything is a little naive. So, to discern between different materials, I think, is very, very important.
So, before I talk about the emotional burden of absorbing what you're saying, let's cover some of the details. Right now, how much of our waste does the U.S. recycle?
I think it's somewhere in the 30 percentile range. This began primarily in the late 80s, and it's been growing throughout the 90s and maybe the first decade of this century. Then it's been held relatively flat since then. So it may have hit 40, but I think we're still in the 30s. I haven't looked at it in the last few months.
And what types of products are most often recycled?
Well, we recycle aluminum, we recycle our bimetal tin cans, we recycle our various forms of paper and cardboard. Most of your listeners would, of course, know all of that because so many Americans recycle now. But there's a lot of commercial recycling as well, and composting is something that's relatively new.
And we mentioned plastic. There's lots of different kinds of plastic. Is that part of the reason why you say it makes less sense to recycle it?
Well, the conclusions I've reached really stem from the life cycle literature, which looks at the cradle-to-grave impact, environmental impact, of using various materials. And so, for example, a life cycle scholar could look at what are the environmental implications of putting a plastic bottle in a landfill and then compare that with the environmental implications of recycling it. And so a good study will include all the transportation costs and all the processing costs and everything, both environmentally and also the cost of having to manufacture that, would it be a plastic bottle? So each material does have its own very unique life cycle signature associated with it. So, plastic just isn't on the list of things that benefit the environment when you include both economic and environmental costs.
So I want to kind of drill down into the factors that you consider. You mentioned
Sure. The
transportation costs in the process of recycling. You try to look at the original cost of making that product. So
Yes. Tell
me more about what you look at there, because you're looking both at, I assume, the labor that goes into that product, the raw materials.
Right. And the raw materials these are environmentally damaging things to mine from the earth. So, for example, let's just take an aluminum can for a moment. If we take that aluminum can and put it in a landfill, it costs us money to transport it there. That transportation process has environmental implications to it. While it sits into the landfill, it also has environmental implications with it. So it's not a good thing to put it in a landfill. But it turns out the most important reason for why we should recycle that aluminum can is that we have to, if that recycled aluminum can would replace one that was being made from virgin material, that process of making aluminum from the ground up has a lot of life cycle implications to the environment. So it turns out that's the driver in a lot of these materials is the replacement cost, we'll call them, manufacturing of them. And so it just turns out that plastic is, although still environmentally damaging to produce, is much less so than producing aluminum. Glass also is fairly benign in terms of production relative to aluminum and these other products. So, each product has a very different process and signature. And so I think a really smart recycling system would look at each product individually as opposed to just saying we need to have zero waste as a big goal or something.
So if you're looking at the profile of each product, then I assume changes in the economy, changes in costs of raw materials. I'm thinking particularly recently changes in oil prices, as oil prices are lower now than they were a few years ago. That would then affect your calculations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oil is probably a big driver, especially when it comes to transportation costs and energy costs in general. So that strikes another good point, is we need to keep an open mind about all of this and maybe redo recycle analyses as these conditions change. Lots of things don't change as well. I'm not certain that every result would change dramatically, but certainly we want to keep on top of the latest data.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Professor Thomas Kinnaman, chair of the Economics Department at Bucknell University. What do you think about this? Are you an avid recycler? If so, why? When did you start recycling? What powers you to do it? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Professor Kinnaman, when I hear you say that you have to keep an open mind and sort of constantly be making sure that the calculations of what makes sense to recycle and what doesn't are fresh and are reflecting the true costs, a couple things come to mind. One is that I've always had the sense, as the recycling movement built, that the implied argument was, okay, it may not make economic sense, financial sense, to recycle a small collection of bottles or plastic, but if enough of us do it, if it's big enough, it will be efficient enough that it will change the dynamics and save the environment.
And certainly that's true in all kinds of production processes. Economies of scale do exist. And as you do things at a larger scale, you can usually take advantage of certain efficiencies and specialized labor and other resources to make sure the job gets done very well. So definitely. And there's a truth to that, in the sense that, one reason recycling is kind of expensive is that not every household does it. So you have, if for example, in abstract, if you have one out of three households recycling, the truck still has to go down every block and pick everything up. And if everybody recycled, you'd have more material for the same amount of effort. from the collector's perspective.
Yeah. So it would seem to me that says let's keep plugging, let's keep recycling pretty much everything, because eventually it will be a positive critical mass.
Yeah, but then you look at not just the collection. It's possible, certainly. But again, the work I've done and the research I've reviewed on this, a lot of this research has been done in Europe. They were very interested in life cycle signatures associated with various materials. They've had a long-standing debate in Europe, the European Union, between landfilling and incineration. The northern parts of Europe relies more on incineration, and the southern parts of Europe rely more on landfilling. So this sparked a lot of scholarship over there to try to figure out what's best. And a lot of those studies also looked at recycling systems and how those fare against landfilling and incineration. And so you had a question about something.
I was just saying, even if you look at these individual profiles, snapshots in time, and conclude we're not really helping the environment much and we're certainly not making money recycling this item or that item, I'm saying, don't you need to sort of just keep the movement going to get to a critical mass where it does work?
Well, on the margin, you can still be, now I know my point. Those studies look at, so a plastic bottle is each one, and whether it's a lot of them or one, just to break it down per bottle, you have to, has to go through a process to be recycled, and that requires a certain amount of energy. And although there are some savings from returns of scale that we talked about, those are, I would say some of those are fairly robust. So if it's more burdensome for the environment and the economy to recycle, say, plastic, and then we do it at a larger scale, it's possible. We could wishfully think that the costs are going to come down tremendously with the scale, but my sense is that some of those things are fairly robust.
We need to take a short break. We've got people who want to be part of this conversation, and we certainly welcome more people who have a thought about this. What is your reaction to the idea that it may not make environmental sense to recycle certain items? Is recycling the one area where you really are environmentally conscious? Do you take other steps to reduce your carbon footprint? We're interested in all of this. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about recycling today. Paper, soda cans, old electronic devices, cans that held fruits and vegetables. Our guest this hour says we should prioritize recycling these kinds of materials. Glass and plastic? Not really. I'm speaking with Professor Thomas Kinnaman, chair of the economics department at Bucknell University, former director of the school's environmental studies program. Does it seem obvious to you that there's value in most of the stuff we've used and tossed, and a really smart system would be able to capture that value? Call us at 410-662-8780 with your thoughts, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Professor Kinnaman, what are we really trying to accomplish through recycling as you see it?
I think that goal has changed over time. Originally, I think there was a worry that landfills were running out of landfill space. This was a concern that was expressed in the, mid-'80s and early 90s, and so it was really a matter of saving our environment that way.
I think the
objective is really to try to minimize whatever we do in life. We want to try to minimize the environmental implications of those actions, and in some cases, recycling does an amazing job of doing that. So we measure environmental impacts by how much carbon we produce in our activities, how much sulfur and various nitrates that we produce, particulate matter. These are all things that are damaging to human health, to the natural ecosystem, to the environment in general. And so what can we do? How can we change the way we live in such a way to minimize these environmental measures? And it turns out recycling does impact those things. And so I would say that's the modern goal, is to just to take a smallest environmental footprint that we can as we lead our lives.
You mentioned concern about overfilling landfills or tossing, not recycling and burdening landfills. I think a lot of us remember the trash barge that was stuck, the Mobro, in 1987. Remind us or tell people who weren't around for that about that event and what kind of impact you think it had on how we think of recycling.
And it's, I think it's been mentioned by others as well, the effect of this famous, the voyage of this famous barge, the Mobro, which left Brooklyn. It was really a young entrepreneur thought that I can, you know, Brooklyn municipalities are willing to pay something like $70 or $80 per ton of garbage to dispose it. So I can put it all into a barge and take it down to South Carolina or someplace and dispose it maybe for $20 or $10 a ton and make some money that way. And so it was a business plan. This person started accepting garbage and starting taking the fees for doing so in up in New York, but hadn't yet secured his destination. And so once it was en route, he was trying to find a place to dispose the stuff. What really happened was that there were new laws recently that prevented hazardous waste from going in landfills. And all the landfills that would have loved the business down in South Carolina, other places, sorry to pick on South Carolina, it was just one of the places, but and through the Caribbean, would have loved the business, but they there was a worry that there was, you know, hazardous waste in that stuff, and so then they started saying no. And so every night, it was kind of as a continuing news story, and it must have been a slow news season, because it was many nights it was the leading story, where on the national news, it was the update on where the garbage barge is today, and it's been denied by yet another port for disposing its garbage. And so I think the collective sentiment was that the United States is simply out of landfill space, that we've produced so much waste for so much time, nobody was really watching, and we've just done it. We've overburdened ourselves. And so it was scary to some people, I think. And soon after, if you look at when state recycling laws were passed, they were passed within a few years of this famous barge. So it was... And it turns out there was plenty of landfill space. The number of landfills was going down tremendously. If you think back in the 1950s and 1960s, every town, every municipality had its own little town dump that usually is on the edge of town, maybe down in a wetland area. It was the worst place to dispose waste back then, but that's what they did. And in 1976, the federal government said, no, you can't have that kind of landfill anymore, that kind of dump. You have to cover your stuff, you have to protect the groundwater, etc. So there's a whole new book of rules. And so a lot of these town dumps just closed. And so it wasn't too hard for a reporter to look at these numbers and say, wow, look at the number of landfills that are closing. We're going to run out any time now. When in their place we're being built these super regional landfills that we see today that can take on plenty of waste. So there's plenty of reasons to hate garbage, but running out of space on the land is pretty low on the list, in terms of, at least in this country. In some parts of the country, the Northeast, certainly in parts of East Asia, Southeast Asia, parts of Northern Europe, where land is very scarce, it's a different story. And landfills are, you know, the land issue is a big issue, finding space for them.
We have a call from Al on the Eastern Shore. Al, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi. Your comment.
I was wondering, I have a story. It was in the Popular Science some time ago, and it talked about the Germans using glass with asphalt in their roads, and it had worked out very well because the wear on the roads was quite reduced, and so it was all around a good idea for recycling, and it kind of leads you to believe that we ought to keep an eye on everything for future uses recycling that we hadn't thought of.
Al, I appreciate the call. Before I ask you for your comment, Professor Kinnaman, I'd also like to talk to Beth in Baltimore, because I think she's talking about something similar with plastics. Beth, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
So, yes, about maybe 4 years ago, I listened to a very inspiring TED Talk by Mike Biddle, who is a plastics guy. And what he talked about was his company was able to come up with this system to recycle, you know, almost any kind of plastic into this little pellet, which is the base plastic to make everything out of. Again, the idea with plastics is it's a petroleum product, right? So the idea is to keep it in the ground. He said that we should look at plastic the way we look at any other element, like, you know, copper, silver, whatever, that once it's up out of the ground, we should use our best efforts to just keep reusing it rather than treating it as something that should be, you know, basically mined all the time and this unlimited resource. So I was just curious if the speaker had any opinion on this particular, you know, theory regarding plastic.
Beth, thanks for the question. Professor Kinnaman, what about that? They both seem to be talking about not taking a product back to its most basic term, but sort of putting it in some form that changing its physical shape, perhaps, but still using it. In the case of Al calling us from the Eastern Shore, using glass as part of pavement.
Yeah, these are all wonderful ideas. There are organized markets for the selling and buying of recycled products, whether it be glass or aluminum or plastics. Anybody can go get them. You can present a bid and purchase this stuff. And so if anyone has great business ideas for what to do with these materials, the market price right now is very low, and sometimes it even goes negative. In other words, you'll get paid to take the stuff. So the more great innovative ideas for using this materials, the better will be, I think. By the way, if that were to happen, if there was, for example, glass could be used in road building, and that was really working well for the road builders. They said this is a great new product and it leads to greater, smoother roads down the line and everything. Demand, everybody will want some, right, because it's this great material, and so the price will rise. And so markets do have the ability to shift resources to where they're really highly valued. And now prices for things like aluminum and bimetal and even lots of fiber and various paper and cardboard, prices have been very high there, which means that there's a lot of people who really want it. I'll take that stuff and I'll make my product with it or something. And where prices are lower, for some reason, these great ideas are not making it at the high enough level to demand this stuff and encourage municipalities to collect more of it to make money off of the sale of it. Instead, too much of our plastic gets put in a container and shipped to China, where it's processed there for whatever reason. I mean, the market has very, very strange ways of sorting these things out, but they're the highest bidders right now. And so maybe we are just one great invention or entrepreneurial idea for how to use this stuff away from making it economical and therefore probably more environmentally sound if we don't have to ship it so far. So all good possibilities. The market is ready. It's there. Anyone can go buy it and start using it for anything they want, and you can get it really cheap right now. People aren't lining up to buy it right now.
That is Professor Thomas Kinnaman, Chair of the Economics Department at Bucknell University, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about recycling and when it makes sense and when it may not make sense. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Joe is calling us, I think, with another economic point. Joe calling us from Bel Air. Welcome.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. I was just wondering if the professor could talk a little bit about the concept of energy return on investment and as it relates to this whole concept of recycling, because it seems to me that two factors with the energy return on investment and as it relates to reusing the materials, and then on a subsequent point, he seems to have just touched on the other point I was going to bring up, which is the marketplace, it seems to me, will eventually, potentially, incentivize people to recycle at a greater degree than they currently are. The day may come where we're being paid for our refuse the way that we recycle some materials around our house, where we can take aluminum and tin and copper, where there's a economic advantage to recycling it. I just wonder what his thoughts are on that.
Joe, thanks for the call. Professor Kinnaman, could you hear Joe's points?
Yes, I heard those two good points very well. I'll take the latter one first, only because we did kind of just touch on that. Absolutely, and there are some materials that command very high prices. Joe mentioned copper, and no one's worried about copper going in the landfill because you'd be not very smart to do that. If you got your hands on a lot of used copper, you could make a lot of money selling it. And so why is it so high for copper? Why is it so low for plastic? And again, copper can be, people have great ideas for how to use copper to build things, probably pipes and other stuff. But Joe touched on another point, the role that economic incentives play. I mean, I'm an economist, so I buy into that. It's, the incentives can be very powerful. They change the way we behave. If suddenly your cardboard boxes were worth $10 each in the marketplace, you don't have to be an advocate of recycling. You could be the worst environmentalist in the country. It'll change your behavior. It's the invisible hand of capitalism that gets us all moving in that direction. Not that it's solving all of our problems in society, but boy, those incentives certainly do change behaviors in ways that sometimes we need them to be changed. And so what economists look for when these prices are low, we want to ask why they're low, and more importantly, we want to know, does that price reflect the overall value of that product, not just the market value? I mean, if you are using a recycled aluminum can, you're saving that can from the landfill, and there's a certain societal benefit to doing that, which will not be represented in the price of that aluminum can. And also the whole issue of having to manufacture that can, again, another one, from virgin material. Now, there are market costs associated with that, but all the environmental spillovers associated with mining are not included in the price of that recycled aluminum can. So, and that's kind of what environmental economists do, is we look at the marketplace, we respect the role that it plays in it, but then we realize that sometimes the prices are just wrong. They don't represent the overall cost of society. And so we imagine certain subsidies, for example, or taxes on bad things, subsidies on good things, not as a means of raising revenue for the government, but just to get the price right. And so I advocate for much more recycling of aluminum and tin, and I think there needs to be substantial subsidies to make people encouraged to do so. Unfortunately, I'm not advocating for more recycling of paper, I'm sorry, of plastic and glass, and so because they don't have the wonderful environmental benefits that these other products have. So, the role of incentives play is going to be always there. Now, there was another question Joe had regarding energy and return on investment to energy. It's in the model, I can tell you, that the reason why I think I advocate so heavily for aluminum can recycling is that it's very energy intensive to make aluminum again, and so recycling really can save us a lot of energy. In other words, it's included in the overall analysis with the carbon, with the other environmental spillover effects, certainly the energy consequences of our actions. Life cycle model will include all of those, including the environment, the spillover effects from energy use, carbon, and other types of things.
Let me interject a question we got by email from Monica, who wrote, I heard that recycling glass was good because the amount of energy required to turn sand into glass was much higher than remelting glass, which causes greenhouse gases. Explain the economics of glass recycling, Monica asked.
If those are the only two processes involved, like we had, we either manufacture glass from sand or we break it down from recycled bottles, and that was the only impact, the only aspects of the whole life cycle process, then yes, definitely. The life cycle model would reflect it. The people who do these studies aren't biased in any way. But often glass, you know, has to all be collected, it's very heavy. I think there is glass that goes to China. I think the glass that's collected in my hometown in Pennsylvania gets shipped to West Virginia for processing. It could be that the people who are making glass out of sand are located right next to the sand sources, and so there's not as much transportation going on. I mean, these are all of the critical details that go into these studies. Apparently there's other factors that are overwhelming that good point, but it is true that it's easier to make it out of broken glass.
The rest of Monica's point She wrote, "Personally, I think we, living in a consumer economy, should focus on pressuring the Walmarts of the world to take back the packaging materials their products are sold in. Product packaging, to me, is the most offensive." What would you say to Monica on that point about the business that sells a product being responsible for?
That's called a producer responsibility measure, and it's done for some products. It's certainly done in Germany with all the bottles that are produced there. It's the Green Dot program, and manufacturers of beverages maintain ownership of that beverage container so that once the consumer uses it, it once again becomes the property of the original manufacturer, and so they've got to figure out a way to get that stuff recycled or whatever. So there's two. So to address that point, producer responsibility measures is simply another way to change incentives, just like the tax and subsidy I spoke about before. So step one in any kind of process is what should be recycled. We really just look at what it actually takes, what materials are being used, how much energy is being used, how much air pollution is being produced from a landfill and from a recycling process. If it makes sense in that laboratory setting to recycle a certain material, then step two is what kind of incentives or what kind of policy do we need to enact to make it so, to make it so people will do it. And so if something turns out to be beneficial to recycle, then producer responsibility measures is one of the menu options that we have in terms of policy. And there are economists that study the different policies and the nuances associated with them, but it's certainly been shown to be effective in some products. So,
Professor,
but I would disagree with her on not for all packaging, but just those packaging materials that make sense in the first place to recycle.
Professor Kinnaman, we need to take another quick break here, and we'll continue this conversation when we get back. Professor Thomas Kinnaman, chair of the Economics Department at Bucknell University. We're talking about recycling and when it makes sense and when it doesn't. Join the conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about recycling. We're talking to Professor Thomas Kinnaman, chair of the Economics Department at Bucknell University. We're discussing the advantages and disadvantages to the United States approach to recycling. Greg is calling us from Annapolis with a point about recycling. Hi.
I just wanted to make the point, if it hasn't already been, that a real reason to recycle plastics is just to keep it out of the waste environment. It's very detrimental to, you know, sea life and organisms, and it breaks down into tiny, tiny little pieces that are impossible to extract and then can really get into the chain of life in the ocean. And, you know, so that's a reason beyond any other, you know, basic economics reason.
Greg, thank you for calling us. We also have an email from Mia saying, what will we do with the billions and billions of plastic bottles we don't recycle? Add them to the giant Pacific garbage pit? We've worked so hard to change people's perspectives on reusing and recycling. It seems a shame to undermine that. If certain materials are not good recycling candidates, we should look at using less of those materials. Professor Kinnaman, how do you respond to all that?
Well, source reduction can be a winner, and that's really not part of the research I've done. It's, from my vantage point, we have this material. It's already been produced. What do we do with it? Do we recycle it, or do we put it in landfill or the incinerator? So, but yeah, where source reduction is, you know, stop using as much of this stuff, you know, and then we don't have to confront the question of dirty recycling or dirty landfilling.
And, of course, that is the mantra, reduce, reuse, recycle. Recycle is the third part of that.
Yeah.
Do you think that our focus on recycling tends to give short shrift to the other two?
It might. It might. I'm going a little bit beyond my area of economic expertise. But, you know, you think about these ideas for as long as I have, and you wonder whether or not, you know, is recycling sort of this gateway activity that once we sample it and we like it and we become more environmental, and before you know it, we're doing more for the environment. We're engaging in source reduction. We might start riding our bike to work because because it's caught on and we've become wonderful recycling advocates and recycling practitioners, or sorry, environmental advocates and environmental practitioners. Or is it the opposite, that we, I recycle, so I've done all I need to do to atone for all of my other environmental behaviors that aren't maybe as good. And so is recycling giving people an out, that they now feel that I don't need to engage in anything else? And it's a very easy out because my city is making it very easy for me. And so I don't know. That's kind of more of a psychological question, isn't it? Or, you know, a sociological question that I'm sure people could weigh in on, maybe some of your listeners. But it's one that I toy with myself. I don't know what the answer to that.
Do you still recycle?
I do.
What do you recycle?
I recycle my plastic even.
You recycle your plastic?
Once you get going, it's just, I've been doing it for, and I entered this research as completely ambivalent. I was just like, I was curious. I was hearing about how recycling plastic is not so great. And so I'm like, let me look into it. Let me study these life cycle models and combine them with economic data and figure out what's worthwhile with a very open mind, and was kind of surprised. And I lived with my results for a year before I published them, saying, could this be true? So it wasn't easy for me to make the step. And so, yes, I understand that when I put my plastic bottle in the recycling bin, it's probably going to be, it could be shipped to China. It could be shipped all over this country. And, you know, there's a landfill 10 miles from me that would take it. You know, what's best for the environment, you know, with those two possibilities in mind? So I don't know. We still recycle. Plenty of economists have estimated that people just like the act of recycling. We just like it, even if we don't know what happens. We think it might be good, but we actually like the process of it. And so I'm going to continue recycling, even if it's something that might not be so great for the environment. It's a habit I like to do. And we certainly do other things that are not great for the environment, you know, when we drive our cars or when we go consume other items. So if you really like recycling that much, then continue doing it. Just know that there's a carbon footprint associated with that.
So I just want to dwell on that thought for a minute, because it's the logical implication of what you've been saying. You're talking about where the numbers lead one. So if it's not a net positive for the environment, it's a negative. The chance that it's neutral is pretty slim. It's actually increasing. You think recycling plastic actually increases our environmental footprint?
Results are very clear about that, yes.
We got an email from Ben in Havre de Grace who says, the comparison your guest has thus far drawn between the cost to produce new materials versus recycling discarded ones is only part of the picture. And we may have addressed this, but I'm not sure either. I've not yet heard him account for the cost of not recycling. That much stuff has to go somewhere. Eventually, we are going to run out of room to bury our trash, and a lot of it is ending up in the environment. If he would have us believe it doesn't make sense to recycle some materials, then what would he have us do with them instead?
Sure, and so I feel the need to discern between two possibilities. You can put a plastic bottle in your garbage and have it be collected by a responsible collector and put into a landfill where it's buried immediately. And that particular plastic bottle is not going to make its way into the Pacific Ocean. There are people who dump openly in the Pacific Ocean, and there are people who leave their bottles carelessly on the edge of their boats and they get blown into the water. And that's litter. That's a separate issue. This is managed waste disposal, collection and disposal. So. But you're right, the bottle's going to go somewhere, and if it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or in a growing pile that we're running out of room with, how many more piles can we build? I think that the long-term future is going to be a reversion back to incineration, to capture or to recycle or whatever word you want to use, the energy content of that plastic bottle. It's a pathway that's been taken by the Germans. They've built a lot of recent incinerators. Japan has gone the direction of incineration. The Netherlands, a lot of other Northern European countries rely on incineration. These incinerators are not the same old messy incinerators that we experimented with in the 1970s and 80s in this country, which were horrific environmental polluters. But the new process, the burn is much at a higher temperature. I've heard that these really efficient modern incinerators produce less air pollution than a household chimney, and that they produce a lot of energy. My guess, just guessing now, is that if we were to do this radio show 20 years from now, I think that's where the plastic bottles are going to be going. Landfilling is kind of not a permanent solution. And the Europeans look down on landfilling, but they embrace incineration, the new kind of incineration.
Michelle in Canton is calling us with some insights about what happens in Germany. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call, and I really appreciate everything that the professor is saying. My experience in Germany for 22 years, the 22 years that I lived there, was that the Germans are very, very involved also in getting everything recycled. So if you buy anything that's in a plastic beverage container, they also have receptacles that you can take those containers back to, and you actually get your deposits back in the form of a receipt that you can cash in at the register. But they also have collection areas for paper, plastic, batteries, all of the kinds of things that are usual wastes, and the stores are also involved in getting rid of those things, making sure that the paper is going to be recycled into a paper that can be used. And I also agree that there is some incineration going on, but it is very, very clean, and you see very, very little litter in the streets or anywhere in the cities. And unfortunately, I do see a lot of waste in Canton on a sailboat in the marina where we are, with so much waste that is just ending up in the water, and it just hurts to see that.
Michelle, I appreciate the call. Professor Kinnaman, let me also add, so Hyla's email, she said, I grew up in Germany where we have been taking green initiatives very seriously since the 80s. Researchers quickly found out that certain materials were more expensive to recycle than produce. Restaurants were discouraged to use glass dishware because it wasted too much water, another valuable resource. But instead of giving in to the seductive argument that recycling is unsustainable, German policies encouraged R&D and more efficient water use and better materials transport to keep doing the right thing in a financially sustainable way. How can we in the U.S. continue to do the right thing here in the face of research that questions recycling's viability?
Well, and those recycled bottles and plastic bottles in Germany, there's somebody who really, really wants those, and that's all the incinerators. I think the recycling industry right now is mildly threatened by the new generation incinerators that are coming up, because the incinerators want them because they have a lot of energy content in them and it will drive down the fuel costs. If they can get more plastic or paper into our incineration, then we won't have to use as much gasoline to keep the thing going at very high temperatures. So it's going to be interesting. I think we're going to start seeing at the industry level some debates between modern, efficient incineration and recycling. But you know that wonderful tradition in Germany, all was it grew out before the data we're in. We didn't know at the time what happens, how much energy goes into recycling a plastic bottle, how much does it cost to take it to the recycling plant, and then how much do we save by not having to build a new one. This, all these elements of the life cycle literature are really within the last 10 or 15 years. So if the culture embraces it, I'm part of that culture. I've embraced it as well. And sometimes the data then comes later, and you look at it with unbiased, just looking at it, and you're like, whoa. And it's kind of a wake-up call. Maybe this great progress that we've been making, if you want to call it progress, maybe it was, if for certain materials it wasn't worthwhile and that we should focus on. You know, I don't think we recycle enough aluminum. I think we need to really be serious about that. If we have a limited amount of recycling energy, let's make sure we recycle the things that really matter, including, by the way, e-waste, some of the toxic elements that we use, batteries and those kinds of things. Let's get our minds off of plastic, which is not paying the great dividends that other products could be paying. So it's.
And when you say e-waste, it covers a lot. What in particular do you have in mind that we should be focusing on?
Well, there's cell phones and laptops and your old desktop and video screens and television sets and anything that has circuit boards on it. These are, first of all, there's some valuable materials in that. And secondly, the recycling processes, when done irresponsibly, as they are done in places like Ghana and China, are hazardous to life, human life. We've got people there who are recycling, quote unquote, the circuit board on the computer by burning it in a little fireplace and capturing the precious metals. And then, you know, being exposed to all kinds of toxins and carcinogens and things like that. So we don't take. I would love it if the public focus would move towards e-waste, because that's some nasty stuff. And one of your callers called in about the the minor issues, not minor, but the little known issues about plastic, how it breaks down, and so those are bad. But let's keep in mind that if we had to rank things and get things done one at a time, e-waste is much worse.
We got an email from Chris who picks up on I think one of the details that Michelle mentioned about her time in Germany. Chris writes, could you ask your author about returnable bottles? If manufacturers were to make these available, I believe that many consumers would buy them. It seems that this is another option for reducing waste. I remember returning bottles for reuse, they were going to be sterilized and used again, not recycled. Is that something we should be going back to?
It goes back to the market and how things change. And we mentioned the price of oil going up and down. 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was just more expensive to make glass, I guess. And so they found that this was not government policy that was requiring the returnable bottles. It was companies saying that we save money. Let's do this to try to save money. And we can get our old bottles back. Then we can clean them and refill them and save money doing so. And then what's changed over the last 50 years is, and I'm not an expert on the glass manufactured industry, but I'm guessing that there have been innovation and advancements to make production of glass from sand just easier than it was at the time. And so it's shifted the scale back to just don't return it. And if it made sense, again, it's a good deposit returns is a very effective incentive. And so that's step two of what I was talking about before. First of all, does it make sense to recycle glass? And if it turns out that if we compare the life cycles of recycling it and throwing it in the garbage or whatever, and it says, yes, this one is a good one, then you have economists, you'd have everyone on board saying, we have to incentivize this because this is a valuable thing to recycle. But to jump to step two, saying we should just recycle glass because it's a good thing to do, without asking that first question, is it the right thing to do, is missing the point, I think.
Professor Kinnaman, we have just a half minute left. When people get asked at the store, paper or plastic, should they choose plastic?
They should choose plastic.
Better to bring a reusable bag?
Yeah. No. The fabric bags that you use are the best. But the cost to the environment and to the economy of producing paper bags and disposing them is much higher than the cost of the economy producing plastic bags and disposing them. And it's this just is the tip of the iceberg on all of the things that we don't know about when we lead our lives.
Tip of the iceberg, and I really do appreciate the conversation. We are flat out of time. Thank you so much.
Using styrofoam is actually environmentally better than using a ceramic cup and washing it.
Okay, more to think about. Professor Thomas Kinnaman, Chair of the Economics Department at Bucknell University. Thanks to Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and Roland Avenue in Roland Park. On the web, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. Sunday is Juneteenth, the oldest known celebration commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. We'll talk about emancipation in Maryland. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.